All right, I'm very happy to be here. It's always a pleasure to be in Santa Barbara. I'm not a mathematician, so you'll have to bear with me. Parts of the talk will be very physical, but I can tell from the first talk that that may be okay or conversant with lots of the language. So I'm gonna try and talk about a new attempt to determine Ricci flat metrics on smooth K3 surfaces. To the extent that there are new things in the talk, it's based on joint work with Arnav Tripathi, who's a mathematician at Harvard, and he's present. And Max Zemet, who is a student at Stanford, shown in one of his typical poses here. Okay, you'll see as we go on by the end of the talk that the work enjoys connections to earlier or also naively distinct approaches that are dual. Earlier work appears in, for instance, the paper Green et al. That derives semi-flat metrics on K3 surfaces, work by mathematicians Gross and Wilson, that derived an approximation of the K3 metric. We'll see that both of these are sort of steps along a systematic path that we're elaborating that could lead to an exact formula, we hope. And then there's an ongoing program of research by a mathematician in Boston, Yuxian Lin, that's in some sense dual to what I'll talk about. Okay, so we've already heard a lot about Kaladiyam manifolds in the first talk. There's famously Kaladi conjecture. It gives a topological condition for a space to admit a Ricci flat Kaler metric. There's a unique Ricci flat Kaler metric on a Kaler manifold of vanishing first string class for each choice of the Kaler form. I hope that's accurate. Dave will correct me if it's not. Okay. And this was proved by Yao. The result is very famous. It's non-constructive. It doesn't give the metric. And in fact, as I was discussing with people at break, it's an interesting fact that we know a lot more about the moduli spaces of these Ricci flat metrics than we do about the metrics themselves.
My only comment is that when Kaladi made the conjecture, he was a young man.
Uh-huh.
And when Yao proved it, he was a young man.
Okay. are you judging them based on their pictures, Dave? That was before cameras, yeah. Okay, so now here's a picture of M-theory and its five sort of, I guess there are six on this slide, six up to, you know, dualities, perturbative limits. String theorists are interested in Kaladiyam manifolds, not because they're broadly interested, though they tend to be, but because these spaces solve vacuum Einstein equations. Superstrings in M-theory naturally live in higher dimensions. You need to compactify to get to something like four dimensions, and in the simplest thing that you do, not the only thing, but the simplest thing you do is you add nothing else and solve vacuum Einstein equations. Okay, so concretely, for instance, if you looked up Joe Polchinski's book that was written here and in Texas, you'll find a nonlinear sigma model that lives on the string world sheet with target at Kaladiyam M. Okay, and it looks something like this. There's a hopefully implicitly known Ricci flat metric, Gij, that depends on X, and then there are these world sheet fields, X. Okay, and so the most basic questions you'd ask about observables if you were infinitely powerful in string compactification on M would be decided about by facts about the geometry of M itself. Okay, strictly, this Gij is only the metric given by Yao in the large volume expansion, but the case we'll study is actually a bit better. Okay, now, we actually can't be this naive because we don't know very much about G, and so string theorists have done, and mathematicians have done other clever things to learn about physics. But the dumbest thing you would do is say, give me the metric G and I'll learn about physics. So the upshot of these introductory slides is that although we don't, and we've made a lot of progress without it, it would still be nice to know the Ricci flat metric on M. Okay, and it would be good not to forget this problem in view of all the other progress we've made not knowing it. Okay, so today I'll describe a conceptually new approach, at least to me, to this problem, its relations to other ideas that seem distinct but can be dual, and the kinds of formulas that it leads to. Okay, so our approach right now only applies to hyper-Kaler metrics. So, for instance, on the simplest compact Kaladiyam K3, our approach could conceivably work. And the quick summary of what I'll show you today is that one can determine an exact K3 metric given knowledge of the spectrum of BPS states of some auxiliary, totally different supersymmetric theory. This is only progress to the extent that it's easier to determine the spectrum of BPS states. From a physicist's point of view, that seems like a vaguely topological question. It seems like a question of Donaldson-Thomas theory or Gromov-Witten theory. It seems a little easier, but that might be wrong. So we'll see.
So I criticize all the pictures. that's the Kummer surface, and I know it's metric.
Okay, yeah.
It's flat.
Thank you. That would not get you tenure in a math department, though. Okay. Yeah, I agree. But it's not smooth then.
That's right.
Okay, fine. So now I'm going to talk about little string theories.
It was obviously not smooth in the picture.
I don't know. That's some random slice. I just put these pictures up. I went to Google Images and found a picture. Okay, what do you want from me? Okay, so I'm going to talk about little string theories and their moduli spaces of vacua. One of the discoveries of the mid-1990s by string theorists and field theorists was that there's a zoo of novel theories that were not previously expected to exist. And these now exist quite independent of your knowledge of string theory. You could prove they exist abstractly using string theory, but now they're objects in their own right. But there were two tools of discovery used. One was their D-brains. We heard about them in the previous talk. So the study of low-energy theories that live on these P-brains embedded in the 10-dimensional string theory sometimes decouples and gives a well-defined theory in its own right. Famously, n equals 4 super Yang mills can be obtained that way by decoupling the theory on D3 brains. An alternative way to get such theories is so-called geometric engineering. You study a singular collabial, and you focus on the local physics at the singularity, and I put this in quotes, but really happily, in the first talk by Haskins, this precise notion of local was mentioned right at the start. So you look at local physics near the singularity, in the transverse space, and that gives some kind of field theory that may decouple from gravity. Okay, so one of the simplest collabial singularities is an ADE singularity of a K3 surface. And that particular singularity, like many such singularities, has various dual descriptions in string theory, in terms of D brains or other brains. A kind of brain that you may have heard less about is the so-called Nevo-Schwartz brain. So string theory, in addition to DP brains with various P, has something called NS or Nevo-Schwartz 5 brains. They only exist in 5 dimensions, 5 plus 1. There aren't NS 7 brains or 3 brains or anything else. Now, by carefully studying the physics of the singular K3 or on these brains, you find several new theories, and this was done in 1995 and 96. So very famously, and I'll hope you've heard about it, there's a 2-0 supersymmetric field theory in 5 plus 1 dimensions. This theory is somewhat famous because it can be used to explain the S-duality of maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, because you can derive n equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory by compactifying this theory on a T2, and then the large diffeomorphisms of the torus transmute into the S-duality group, which is highly non-trivial, of the low-energy n equals 4 Yang-Mills. Okay, yeah. So we'll a strong weak coupling duality that inverts the Yang-Mills coupling in some of its transformations. Okay. Now, happily, that's not my subject. Slightly less famously, there's also a theory that reduces, to this at low energies, not to this too, that reduces to the previous theory at low energies, but is not the full string theory. Okay, so it's the so-called little string theory that lives on NS5 brains. It's called a little string theory because it has strings, they're BPS, they play an important role in the theory, but it doesn't have gravity, and it lives only in 5 plus 1 dimensions, not 10. Okay, this latter theory is not a quantum field theory, and it comes with a scale, the scale of the string tension, just like the full string theory does. The simplest such NS5 theory, which again has 2-0 supersymmetry like its field theoretic cousin, has many interesting properties. The simplest one, there's just one 5 brain. It has on its world volume a U1 gauge theory. And compactified on a 2 torus, it gives rise to a theory, okay, that looks like a U1 gauge theory then. I spoke imprecisely. Really, in 6 dimensions, it has a tensor multiple. But that gives a U1 gauge theory in 4 dimensions. And like many such theories, it has a moduli space of vacua. With supersymmetry, the abelian vector field comes with scalar partners. And those scalar partners of the vector span a moduli space called the Coulomb branch by physicists. Coulomb because there are U1 degrees of freedom along the branch, and Coulomb famously studied electromagnetism. Okay, and so along this moduli space, you find, in fact, a geometry that's just the dual of the mirror torus. So up to some Z2s, it's the same as the torus you compactified on. Now, if you take that four-dimensional theory and compactify on an additional circle, you have this torus moduli space in 4 dimensions. You get 2 additional scalars. You have a gauge field A mu. You can integrate it dx mu around the circle to get one more scalar. That gives a Wilson line, which, because of large gauge transformations that become well-defined on the circle, is periodic. Now, that leaves 3 scalars, the 2 from the torus and this Wilson line, plus a 3D photon. But it's a famous fact that you can use the epsilon tensor to dualize a photon into a scalar. And so, really, you have 4 scalars. And from the M-theory picture of this same geometry, you can easily see that this theory has a moduli space that's given by a 4 torus. So the story is we take the simplest little string, you compactify on a two torus, you get a moduli space that's a two torus. Compactify on an additional circle, you get a moduli space that's a very simple hyper-Kähler manifold, a four torus. Don't worry if you're not following this, the details of this part of the talk. We'll transition rather soon, okay? But I review this because I'm going to use an analogous but more complicated system where there is a little string theory whose moduli space is a K3 surface. And the fact that its moduli space is a K3 surface will be important. Okay, so the theory that we were just talking about is a theory that has 16 supersymmetries. If you put it on a torus, it gives something like 4-dimensional n equals 4 supersymmetry, the maximal amount you can have without gravity. The one that we're going to be interested in for this talk is a cousin, actually the first one discovered, at least in some version of history, that has half as much supersymmetry. It has 4d n equals 2 supersymmetry. So we'll review how to geometrically engineer it later, so it just comes from some kind of Calabi-Yau singularity, and you'll be happier with that description. But let me just tell you the salient properties, and then we'll quickly strip away the physics and move to things that might make you happier. Okay, it arises on NS5 brains, just like this theory that had a torus as its moduli space, but now in the heterotic string, a sort of now much neglected cousin of the type 2 strings with D brains that are all the rage. Okay, or you can also get it on D5 brains in the type 1 string, which you can obtain as a Z2 quotient of the type 2 strings. Okay, so it is a D brain theory, but in type 1. Now, one description of it is that at low energies, not exactly because it has strings, but at low energies, it gives a 6-dimensional SU2 gauge theory with 16 doublet hypermultiplets under the SU2, which enjoy an SO32 global symmetry, permuting the 32 chiral multiplets and the 16 hypermultiplets of n equals 2 supersymmetry. Okay, these extra doublets, the extra matter arises because in type 1 theory, in addition to D5 brains, there are D9 brains, and there have to be precisely the number to give SO32 gauge symmetry by anomaly cancellation. Now, when compactifying this theory on a two torus, it is at low energies, an n equals 2 field theory with a rank 1 gauge group, but its Coulomb branch is actually now a sphere instead of a torus. Okay, and in fact, the sphere that you get is well thought of as the sphere that you see in elliptic vibrations of K3, where there's an elliptic K3, the base is a sphere, and at generic points in the moduli space, there are 24 marked points where there are degenerate fibers that don't give rise to singularities of the total space, but that give degenerate elliptic curves. Okay, and in a dual picture, you can actually think of this theory I'm describing as a D brain in F theory, probing this base of the sphere, sorry, this base of the elliptic vibration on which you've compactified F theory. So then, obviously, the Coulomb branch, since the three brains moving around on this sphere, is just the sphere. Now, if you now compactify this theory on an additional circle, you get a 3-dimensional gauge-like theory, but whose moduli space, just like as happens when you compactify F theory on elliptic K3 on a circle, becomes the full geometric K3. The K3 comes to life. Okay, and so there's some kind of 6-dimensional little string whose compactification on a 3-torus gives rise to a K3 surface as the Coulomb branch. The Wilson line of the gauge field, together with the 3D dual photon, just as in the previous case, give the elliptic fiber above each point on what used to be this base sphere of the elliptic vibration. Okay. So that's the hardest physics to digest in this talk. I understand some of it might have been going beyond what you've been forced to deal with in previous iterations of this collaboration meeting. So from now on, I'll try to be more self-contained and use words that will make you happier. Okay, so now we're going to talk about hyper-Kähler metrics from 4-dimensional n equals 2 field theories. So we're going to leave the story I just told you, which had, you know, a Coulomb branch that's a K3 surface as the moduli space of some theory, and discuss some generalities about all 4-dimensional n equals 2 theories. There are two kinds of low-energy multiplets in such theories. They're the things that are superpartners of vectors. So there's a vector field A mu, a gauge field. There's some fermions because of supersymmetry. We always ignore those. And there's a complex scalar, partner of the photon. And then there's something called hypermultiplets, which come as complex scalars Q and Q tilde in some representation R and R tilde, the conjugate representation of the gauge group, and then they're Fermi partners too. Okay. It's more maybe conventional to think of Q tilde dagger, which transforms the same way as Q, and then this gives a sort of set of four fields and makes the hyper-KOR geometry of this moduli space more natural. So I refer to a moduli space. Well, these theories have moduli spaces of vacuo. The supersymmetry forbids any kind of interesting potential. There are two branches in the moduli space. The partners of the vector field may get expectation values, giving a Coulomb branch, which I talked about. Also, if you have these matter fields, which we do, Q and Q tilde, you might give them expectation values by the Higgs mechanism. The gauge field and its partners get a mass, typically, and you get a Higgs branch, which is a hyper-KOR manifold. And then there could be a mixed branch where you partially Higgs, partially don't Higgs the gauge group. Now, in this four-dimensional n equals two theory, Higgs branches are hyper-KOR. Coulomb branches, as in the two examples I did at the start, are special KOR. They don't yet have enough structure to give hyper-KOR manifolds. Okay, or for those of you who are used to Calabi-Yau's, this is rigid special KOR. It's sort of the field theory limit of what a Calabi-Yau moduli space looks like. Now, on compactification to three dimensions, as in my two examples, you dualize the photons, you get a Wilson line from the circle, and the Coulomb branch becomes hyper-KOR too. Okay, so for a one-dimensional complex 4E Coulomb branch, you'd have these fibers given by the gauge field and its dual that turn into scalars when you compactify to three dimensions. For F-theory D3 brain probes, which will be really important intuitively, okay, moving around in the base of some elliptic fibration, you should think of the fibers degenerating where, in the physics language, there are D7 brains, and the D3, D7 strings give light electrons. So in terms of physics, a brain probing a singular elliptic fiber corresponds to some matter field becoming light in the physical theory at that point on the Coulomb branch. So how do you find the metric on the 4D and the 3D Coulomb branch? That's really the point of my story. If we have a Coulomb branch that's K3, and if we know how to find the metric, then we're in business. So I'm going to remind you now of a story that's resulted in several thousand papers, which is Seiberg-Witten theory. Okay, so this is obviously going to be a hasty summary of the most important facts. Let's call the Coulomb branch modulus A. We'll pretend it's a one complex dimensional Coulomb branch, okay, because that's the case that will matter for me. Then for each point on this A plane, you have an auxiliary structure called a Seiberg-Witten curve. In our case of interest, it'll be of genus 1, and you should think of this elliptic fiber I keep on talking about. It turns out that the periods of a preferred meromorphic differential on this curve then determine the geometry of the moduli space. Okay, so by the geometry, I mean we want the metric on the Coulomb branch. So here's the picture. Above each point, this genus 1 curve has an A cycle and a B cycle. I said we have a preferred meromorphic differential handed to us by Seiberg and Witten. Let's call it lambda. Then the definition we'll choose of our coordinate on moduli space is it's the A period of lambda. And then the B period gives us a holomorphic function as we move around on the A plane that we'll call script F. Or more precisely, it gives us the derivative of script F with respect to A. Script F has a physical meaning that makes it clear that you have to view this as its derivative. And then, for instance, the tau parameter of the torus is given by d squared f dA squared. And in fact, it too has a physical interpretation as an abelian gauge coupling. It's the gauge coupling constant of the Maxwell theory governing the U1, the photon on this Coulomb branch. So the central object, the object that determines not just tau and f, but also then the metric by a formula I'll give you on the next slide, is this prepotential f. Again, if you're used to Calabi-Yau's, there's also a sense in which the central object is a prepotential F, and anyone who's heard talks about mirror symmetry knows that all the impressive large numbers of rational curves come by computing this prepotential F. Okay. So in terms of F, this moduli space, this Coulomb branch, is special KOR. In particular, it's KOR. It has a KOR potential, and that KOR potential is the imaginary part of dFdA times A bar. So if you know the Seiberg-Witten curve and you know the differential, and you're strong enough to compute the periods, you can compute the geometry of the moduli space. Now, all states in an n equals 2 theory famously satisfy something called a BPS bound. That is that for a given choice of electric and magnetic charges, so we have on this Coulomb branch a U1 field, a photon, there could be electrically charged particles and there could be monopoles, and in general there could be dions with both charges. There's a function Z, the central charge, that tells you at each point on moduli space what the mass of a state with those given charges has to be larger than. It has to be larger than or equal to something that you compute in terms of the supersymmetry algebra. And the magic of these states is that those which precisely saturate the bound are special with regard to the supersymmetry algebra. Some of the supercharges annihilate them. They're like states that would contribute to an index in math. Okay. And so they're in shorter multiplets because they're annihilated by some supercharges, and they are exactly stable because they have the lightest mass they could possibly have for their given charge. Okay, that's the same reason the electron is stable in nature, whereas the muon that has the same charge is not. Good. Okay, so that's a 4D story. What I've told you is the data that you need to understand a 4D theory in language that would make most physicists very unhappy is a meromorphic differential and some curve of some genus and the periods of this differential. Okay, so we've removed all the physics from the problem. Now, what happens if you put this theory on a circle? Well, the 4D theory had an action. It has many terms because supersymmetry means there's fermions and scalars and all this stuff. But two of the terms are there's an F squared term for the abelian gauge field, and there's an FF dual term, which is the sort of total derivative that's non-zero in backgrounds that have instanton number. So there's a coupling constant E and a coupling constant theta. And at a given point in moduli space, as I said, there's an auxiliary torus in the story, and its tau parameter, given the formula as I told you, is in fact theta over pi plus 8 pi I over E squared. Reducing to three dimensions, this torus becomes physical. Okay, it actually, precisely the Wilson line of the gauge field and the dual photon in three dimensions give you this torus as a piece of the Coulomb branch. Okay, so they have an action that looks like this. Okay, B here is the Wilson line and sigma is the dualized three-dimensional gauge field. The important point is their action, their kinetic terms are determined by the radius of compactification R and the four-dimensional coupling E and theta angle theta. So this gives us a 3D Coulomb branch that's an elliptic vibration over the old Coulomb branch with a projection given by either the S or C map, I forget which map goes which way, and with area controlled by 1 over R. Okay, so this torus becomes very small as you go to four dimensions, which you expect because it's not even part of the moduli space in the limit.
I think that's the C map.
Okay, and Dave says that's called the C map. Good. So the leading large R metric, which is a three-dimensional Coulomb branch metric, and so is hyperkähler, is given by combining the kinetic terms for the new scalars with those of the old 4D Coulomb branch fields, right? The metric on the moduli space appears in the kinetic terms for the scalars. Now, we have a 4D metric that's sort of naive and a 3D metric that I gave you here. So, you know, we'd be done if that was the entire story. There are three sources of interesting physical corrections to a naive classical picture that says you can't just do classical dimensional reduction and declare victory. One, just in the four-dimensional theory, there are one-loop corrections in a D-brain picture where D3 brains are approaching other brains as you move around on this P1 in F-theory. Those come from light states as you approach singular fibers. There are corrections from instantons in four dimensions. This is what Seiberg and Witten sum up in their prepotential. And then there are new instanton corrections that come when you're in three dimensions by taking any four-dimensional BPS particle that preserves some of the supersymmetry and running it around the circle, viewing the circle as Euclidean time. Okay, so we have to sum up all of these corrections at any finite value of R if we're going to give you a precise formula for the kinetic terms and hence the metric on the Coulomb branch. Now, happily, Gayato, Moore, and Knightsky spent a lot of time developing a rather beautiful story for how to compute the hyperkähler metric on Coulomb branches, actually field theories, given the indices that you can define in the following way. So the relevant objects that are going to contribute corrections are BPS particles. BPS particles carry a charge, gamma. They have an electric charge and a magnetic charge, which we could assemble into gamma. Okay. So what we do is we define the following, physicists would often call this a line operator. We define the line operator, x gamma, one for each choice of charge in the charge lattice. It depends on our point in moduli space, which now I've called U, so don't let that confuse you. I was calling it A before. And it depends on a parameter zeta, which I'll define on the next transparency for you. And it depends on a theta angle, which is the Wilson line for the gauge field that couples locally to the charge gamma. So it would be the electric Wilson line for an electron. It would be the magnetic Wilson line for a monopole, and so forth. And this x gamma is the trace of minus 1 to the f. It's an index of e to the minus Hamiltonian times r times this Wilson line. Okay, so and that trace, importantly, is taken in the presence of a massive external probe particle of charge gamma. So this is some kind of index computation, one for each possible charge in the charge lattice. Now, there's a parameter zeta that's sort of implicit here, because I'm taking the trace for, you know, minus 1 to the f with respect to certain supersymmetries. This zeta parameterizes the choice of complex structure on this hyper-Kähler manifold, which is the Coulomb branch, right? So there's a sphere of possible such choices because the space is hyper-Kähler. And so you could define different traces as a function of zeta. In fact, there's a triplet of two forms that come with, you know, such a hyper-Kähler manifold of dimension 4. You can think of them as complex structures or Kähler structures. Omega 1, omega 2, and omega 3, you could think of as the triplet that defines Kähler forms at the top, front, and right of the sphere. Okay, and then in terms of them, you can define omega plus minus and something called omega bar here that depends on xi. And for each choice of, sorry, on zeta, and for each choice of zeta, gives a preferred holomorphic symplectic form. Okay. So in the previous talk, Haskins said that we don't have the joy of using hyper-Kähler geometry. Well, I beg to differ here. We actually do have the joy of using hyper-Kähler geometry, and we are going to use it. Okay. So now it follows from standard results that I barely know, but many of you know better than me in hyper-Kähler geometry, that given this set of forms, you can determine the metric. It's not a shock that given the Kähler form, you can determine the metric. You know it precisely, not just the cohomology class. And in this case, G is given by omega 3, omega 1, inverse omega 2. And it's a result of Gyatow-Moronitsky that if you define y's to be logs of the x's, these traces I defined on the previous slide, and you declare that omega bar is dy dy, for I and j running over a basis for the charge lattice, most conveniently taken to be, say, an electric and magnetic charge. And d prime just means you don't differentiate with respect to the hyper-Kähler parameter, but with respect to the coordinates on moduli space. Then the y's are both coordinates, and this omega bar, this holomorphic symplectic form, is given this formula in terms of the x's. Now, the point of this review of hyper-Kähler geometry is that we've boiled the problem of determining omega, and hence the metric, into a problem of determining a bunch of indices in the presence of BPS states of a four-dimensional n equals 2 theory. Okay? So the upshot, again, if you didn't follow some of the details, is that if we can compute the x gamma for a basis of the charge lattice, we are in business. Okay, so now we're going to try and see how this fits together in terms of some kind of simple formulas. Okay, we don't have the killer final formula I would like, but I can give you some simple discussion of how various formulas would emerge. Okay, so the easiest place to do this will be in a neighborhood of large radius, where the circle is finite but large. Mathematically, that's probably not surprising. Physically, that's clear because from the physical point of view, large radius is the semi-classical limit. There's a coupling that's naturally weak at large radius. Now, recall that to compute a line operator index in charge sector gamma, we needed to evaluate this trace over the Hilbert space of states in the presence of a charge gamma, a heavy external charge with charge gamma, of minus 1 to the f, e to the Hamiltonian, multiplied by the Wilson line. Now, in the large radius limit, this simplifies drastically. The Hamiltonian is just determined by that central charge I defined for all n equals 2 theories that was determined by the prepotential, the thing that governs masses of BPS states. This is the statement that in that trace, the ground state dominates. If there's any excitation above the ground state, the e to the minus 2 pi rh damps it exponentially at large radius. And so in the strict large radius limit, 2 pi rh is just given by, up to kinematic factors, the central charge. Okay. So for the problem at hand, using the 4D formulas for the Coulomb branch geometry, and taking this literally, okay, not yet including corrections, gives something that's known as a semi-flat metric, or to string theorists, it's known as the stringy cosmic string. Okay, it was found in the physics literature by Green, Shapir, Vafa, and Yao. It might have been found in other ways in other literatures. Okay, that is, there are 24 points UA, special points on a P1, which are these 24 points I kept talking about before, where an elliptic fiber degenerates in a smooth, in a general elliptic K3. Okay, and you find a formula for the metric that has a function e to the phi. It has coordinates, basically, u on the 4D Coulomb branch and z coordinates on these elliptic fibers you got by dualizing the photon. And, you know, there's a Hibbs function e to the phi that depends on the singular points where electrons become light and has some modular form in it, the eta function. Okay, but this is an old formula, and I expect it's well known to mathematicians too. So that's great. That would be the limit of the story I'm telling you, where you completely throw out any corrections that come by going from 4 to 3 dimensions. So the interest comes by including instantons. So I can only state the answers in terms of some as yet unknown BPS numbers, which I hope to determine. Again, I'll say I view this as some progress because they are morally more topological information than a metric. So they're the kinds of things that I wouldn't say I, but that, you know, Albrecht Klemm might be able to determine. Okay. So heuristically, you expect this X gamma, this BPS index in sector gamma, will be the semi-flat limit that I just told you, determined by the central charge in sector gamma, plus order constant times, e to the minus constant times r, which comes from the instantons in the presence of that heavy external charge. Now, formally, you can do better than that. The X's solve a Riemann-Hilbert problem. A Riemann-Hilbert problem because not only do they have monodromies, but they have jumps at various points on the Coulomb branch, which is related to some long story about the X's being IR line operators and there being UV line operators. Okay, but this Riemann-Hilbert problem was written down by GMN and can be generalized to our context. And in fact, they solve an integral equation that X gamma at some point on the twister sphere is given by the semi-flat formula times a certain exponential. Okay, the important point is the formula depends on the X gamma prime, so that looks bad. And the formula depends on an unknown function omega, and you can hide a lot in an unknown function. Okay, so these two things both look bad. Okay, so let me now tell you what these functions are. First, omega is just the BPS count of the 4D theory in charge sector gamma. So this is what morally people have been computing for many years in various examples. So this is the thing that I hope is computable. And then the fact that X appears on the both-hand side of the equation isn't really a terrible fact because this can be solved by an iterative technique, okay, where you make an nth guess for X gamma, you plug it into the nth plus first term, and you keep iterating such a guess. And in certain circumstances, which I think includes this circumstance, such an expansion converges. Okay. So really the thing that we've left here is this omega. How do you determine omega? I should say here, there's another approximation known at least to some mathematicians, Gross and Wilson, and something rather similar to their approximation, in a sense I could make pretty precise, to the metric will emerge if you work on a smooth elliptic K3 and you include only very specific corrections in our formalism, only very specific contributions to omega, namely the instanton corrections associated to the UN gauge theory at each electron point that they use. So they think in terms of 24 Oguri-Vafa metrics. Those metrics are associated to UN gauge theory with an electron, and including only those instantons gives the expansion that Gross and Wilson use. Okay. So the most important question for us is how do we determine the BPS invariance instead of just stopping with this subset? Okay. And there are models of the little string in question that suggest how we would attack this question. Okay, so I'll tell you two. The one that I think we're going to try now is that you can geometrically engineer F theory on a certain Calabi-Yau threefold, a priori unrelated to K3, whose BPS states will give us the BPS states that we're after. Okay, so for instance, you can consider an elliptic vibration over P1 times P1. I'm going to be pretty heuristic here. If you put an A1 singularity at a point on one of the spheres and a D16 at a point on the other, and they intersect on a plane, okay, you engineer the 60-well energy theory we started with. The A1 gives an SU2 theory, the D16 gives an SO32. You make sure that the sphere the D16 wraps is non-compact. It becomes a global symmetry. That's precisely SU2 with 16 doublets. If you keep the other sphere compact, you get a little string instead of a field theory. Okay. Now, if we go down from this F theory on an elliptic threefold to type 2A string theory, that gives us a 40 n equals 2 theory, which is precisely the one whose BPS spectrum we need. Okay, so computing the BPS invariance of this theory isn't obvious, but very, very, very similar problems to this have been subjects of intense research for more than 20 years, okay, and the subset we need may or may not be within reach. So that's something we're thinking about now. But the thing that I think is true is that there's an equivalence between the BPS spectrum of some well-defined problem like this and a formula for a smooth K3 metric. Okay, there's another approach which makes contact with a lot of work that I frankly don't really understand, by Yushen Lin, who is a student of Yao's. So if you dualize everything I said, which had three brain probes in F theory, which become M2 brain probes and M theory probing at K3, you could dualize to another frame where my field theory, my 2+1 dimensional field theory, is that on a D4 brain wrapping elliptic fibers of an elliptic K3, leaving 2+1 non-compact dimensions. Then the instantons that we're trying to count are disk instantons that correct the metric on moduli space of this D4. They have, their boundary is a circle on the D4 on one of the cycles of the torus it wraps, and they move out into the bulk and end on one of the singular fibers. Okay? And so there is an approach to this problem, which should be equivalent to the one I've told you, by counting open string Gromov-Witten invariants in an appropriate problem on K3. And that's what Lin has been pursuing. That's all I wanted to say. Thanks for your time.
This all looks like you're not really getting an exact formula, but some kind of approximation, in fact. So from the geometry of the K3 surface, in which kind of limit do you expect this approximation to work best?
So I think the expansion that we're talking about should converge. So I think in a neighborhood of large radius, we should be able to get a formula that's indeed an expansion in instantons, with higher and higher charge instantons being less and less important at large radius. Okay, so in particular, you know, given some instanton numbers, the relevant central charge is what's controlling how much they contribute, so they're exponentially suppressed. Gross-Wilson comes about by including those that are least exponentially suppressed in some particular limits. Okay, what I'm saying is that that's the first, Gross-Wilson is the first term in a systematic expansion that could include more and more such terms, and that, in fact, we think converges in some neighborhood of large radius, and that's the one point we were careful to discuss in our paper at some level of rigor. So I actually think that it is most naturally viewed as an instanton expansion, but that expansion, I think, is convergent at sufficiently large R. Is that your question, or does that answer your question?
Well, from the geometry of the K3, would I get something like an elliptic vibration where the fibers are very small, or would I get...
Correct. Correct. So the formula should be most powerful when the fibers are finite but very small.
So in a lot of ways, this is very close to what we did in the Hitchin moduli space, where we do get this exponential error term, the thing. And I was trying to understand the difference. So I think that the point is that in the Hitchin case, the way that you're sort of healing the singularities is with something that's already exponentially decaying. And whereas in your case, it's Gorevafa that sort of is the cap that provide, you know, is happening over the singular points of the special Kähler metric, right?
I think an important point is that it's not Ogorevafa. That is, if you used literally Ogorevafa, you would get something very much like Gross-Wilson.
Okay.
And that it's precisely instantons that you cannot think of as related to the particular physical theory they studied, that would add further corrections that make Gross-Wilson better.
So
the little string is important precisely because it isn't.
So do you think that model would then have an exponential tail?
Yes.
Okay.
Not literally Ogurivafa. That could give some non-contact metric.
No, that doesn't.
Literally Ogurivafa, but it's gluing into a K3 surface.
No, I understand. Yeah. Because then this trick that Laura Fredrickson developed fully might well be the key to this, which doesn't go through that integral equation, but, you know, it goes through. So, you know, the point is that you do sort of a Gross-Wilson-type construction where you do the gluing, and the moduli look, I mean, it doesn't look like you have something exponentially close, but you have a holomorphic vector field which throws things off to sort of the boundary of the gluing region and into the region where it's exponentially small. So if you know, I think that is an alternate point of view.
That's great, as long as it knows about the global geometry. I think one other thing I would say is that from the physics point of view, though I don't think this has been exploited, there are a large number of other expansions that are at least as natural and maybe in some ways simpler than Ogurivafa.
Yeah.
There's an expansion that would use the physics of SU2 gauge theory with four doublets, four copies of that glued together the appropriate way, that should also give nice formulas for a metric. There's a very large number of such different expansions.
No, I understand.
If one was going to try and correct this, I'm not sure which would be the best to work around.
More questions?
Is there anything particular on the physics of Ricci flat metrics on K3 that you are hoping to learn from this?
Yeah.
Which seems to a naive mathematician a very convoluted way around.
To get the metric, you mean? Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to say it's better than using Yousef. If he has a formula, that's better than Yousef.
I'm asking. Yeah.
Right. So I can tell you a physics question that this would be used to answer. Mm-hmm. That is the first one you ever learn about when you study extra dimensions. My own personal opinion about the urgency of the question is distinct from its naturalness as a question. When you compactify five-dimensional Einstein gravity on a circle, the first thing that you look at is what is the spectrum of Kaluza-Klein modes on the circle. Well, there's fields with mass 1 over r and 2 over r and 3 over r. But if you formalize that into a question, the question you'd be asking is, what is the spectrum of the Laplacian on the circle? Okay, and so somehow knowing explicit facts about the metric would be a first step towards getting explicit facts about the Kaluza-Klein sector of the theory. Again, I'm not going to say how urgent or not urgent that is, but if you were a logical person and saying, I have an extra-dimensional theory, what's the first question? That would be one of the first questions you would ask. Now, physicists are clever enough to say, well, by order of magnitude, there's a squiggle, and that will be this big, and then we can ignore it in this regime. That's what we always do. But there are a host of obvious questions like that that would be more tractable with explicit formulas for the metric. Again, I don't know which, if any, would be urgent.
I mean, just to say, you know, if you want approximations, then there are existing...
Yeah, I view it as a conceptual thing. That is an exact formula, however useful or useless I find aesthetically more pleasing, but that's just me. Let me give one more answer to your question, which the K3 case isn't useful for this, but other cases it would be very useful. A big advance happened in the 90s. You can state this in various different ways, but I think the dumbest way to say it, but also the technically most honest, is that people realized that holomorphy is a good thing. Okay, and so holomorphy has been around forever in math. But there's a particular context in physics, that of very supersymmetric theories or even slightly supersymmetric theories, where holomorphy had not been exploited. And then using really pretty elementary facts about holomorphic functions, the highest brow of which are sort of the Seiberg-Witten theory I described here, people made vast amounts of progress. Okay. Now, there's a similar question that's left over after all that progress, which is if you go to the next observables that aren't governed by holomorphic quantities in supersymmetric theories, they come from the K-Orr potential. Okay, and so again, the dumbest question that you would ask in a supersymmetry class for first-year graduate students is, I have a supersymmetric action, there's two functions, a K-Orr potential and a superpotential, and now we have 25 years of work computing exact superpotentials and all kinds of convoluted, bizarre theories, and no one ever talks about the K-Orr potential. Knowing the metric would be equivalent to knowing the K-Orr potential in some moral sense for a large class of theories. Okay, whether there's something interesting there, I don't know, but you don't know unless you compute it.
Is there a similar story where you use the M5 brain instead of the NS5 brain? Or to put it differently, how do the results depend on the tension of the little string theory?
This is a good question. And let me think about it offline and give you an answer. I mean, the most interesting limit would be, in the limit that the tension goes to infinity, you're going to get a non-compact you're going to get a non-compact slice of the K3 surface. So it's going to enter in rescaling various formulas where I had e to the r's. But let me try to give you a more precise answer.
So you said you expect convergence at large radius. So that must mean there's some finite radius at which it fails to converge. What causes that failure to converge?
So we estimated this in our paper, and the place where it ceased to converge was the place where in string theory on a circle of that radius something interesting happens, which in normal units of humans is root 2 or something. I'm not sure that I'll swear by that, but that was what showed up in the paper. Does it answer your question?
Yes.
Yeah.
Any other questions? All right, let's thank Shaman again.